case for argument this morning is United States against Schuster. Just wait a moment until the rustling dies down.
No problem.
I assume there's nothing about you, Mr. Eisenberg, that's causing all these people to leave.
All the spectators, though.
Surely, if they had known, they would have stayed.
Exactly. Especially since it's...
Okay, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, I'm Mark Eisenberg. I represent Eric Schuster. First of all, page 9, there's a typo. It should be plea hearing instead of sentencing hearing, and that may have caused some concern for the Court, and I apologize for that. The case is really about the scope of a plea agreement and what that contains. The government wants you to separate each specific part of this and say, well, if it doesn't fit into that part, or it doesn't fit into that part, or it doesn't fit into that part, it's not part of the plea agreement, it's not part of the proffer. But that's just silly. And the reason it's silly is because when you look at the entire purpose of the plea agreement, which is to give and take, I give information to the government either reduces the charges or agrees to reduce the sentence, that's how the plea agreement works. And when you look at it in the facts of this particular case, you can see that Mr. Schuster got abused in this plea agreement. We started after we analyzed the case. We get the charges, we analyze it, we look at the discovery, we look at, have a forensic person maybe analyze the computer. We realize we're not going to win. It's time to lessen the damage. And so we start discussions with the government. Hey, we want to plead out. We want to do this. We want to do that. What can we do to lower the sentence? Government drafts a plea letter. Plea letter says, we'll give you acceptance of responsibility as long as you don't act inconsistent with acceptance. Well, how's one way that you can act inconsistent with acceptance? You can lie. That's not acceptance. And so he drafts the letter, and he offers acceptance, and he says right in there, if you engage in conduct which is inconsistent with acceptance, you lose acceptance. We go to the plea agreement. We go to the plea hearing, October 5th, or August 5th. And we had discussions before this about the proffer. The proffer was coming. Dutch agents were coming from the Netherlands to interview my client, and they did that for 3 days at the end of August, a couple weeks after the plea.
Had the proffer letter been signed yet?
No. But there were certainly discussions about it, and you know that there were discussions about it because after I correct the inaccuracy that Mr. Schuster says at the plea agreement, 2 days later, I say to Mr. O'Shea, hey, he was inaccurate at the plea. I don't want him to get I don't want him to lose acceptance. I don't want him to get obstructing. And, oh, by the way, let's finish this proffer deal because it had been discussed many times.
And it's very forthright of you, but the proffer letter had not been signed yet.
No, but think about this. Is that really an issue? I mean, you don't think it is, but I do. And you can't, we go into the plea hearing, and the judge says to him, did you distribute? Distribute isn't an element of this charge. Did you distribute it? What's he supposed to say?
Well, at that point, perhaps defense counsel at the podium ought to either take him aside or say to the judge, Your Honor, I don't think that's part of the factual basis that's necessary, and so, you know, we respectfully decline to answer that question.
Now you're coming after me. But the point is, I'm just kidding you. How would that have gone over with the trial court? I would say, okay, well, he doesn't have to answer that, Judge. How would that have gone over? He's in a rock and a hard place.
Well,
he can't do that.
I would hope the district judge would recognize that it is not a necessary fact for the plea, which was what was occurring, and so the judge would stand down.
Right. But again, we're talking about being open and candid and honest throughout this entire process.
But of course, that's the problem. Statements made to the prosecutor as part of the proffer can't be used, and statements made to the court can be because they're outside the proffer. And your client twice, once in a letter from counsel and once in a letter from your client, twice told the judge that the Alex photos had been distributed. So how does the fact that a statement made to the prosecutor can't be used help?
Well, because
the judge used a statement used statements made to her personally.
We're looking at it again. You're separating each part of this, and that's how the government does it. You can't do that. This is all part of. Why not? Because it's all part of one big picture. It's all part of a plea negotiation and discussion.
That assumes the conclusion. You might as well say our clients entered into a per-offer agreement, and therefore nothing the defendant said to the judge in open court can be used, because it's all part of one big picture.
Well, let's take what Judge Chang said about this. Okay, so I interrupt, and I say, Judge, you can't do that. That's not an element of this, and he shouldn't have to answer it. Then we go to his letter, the second part of this. And in the letter, he says, you know what? I am really sorry for what I did. It was a despicable act. I'm ashamed of myself, et cetera, et cetera. And he never says anything about delivering that to Alex. He doesn't say anything. Is that any different?
But as Chief Judge Easterbrook has identified, your client made a direct statement via the letter to the court. And the court's not part of any plea negotiation.
No, but it's the same thing. Here, we're in a proffer now. We've had the proffer. And what does the proffer say? Anything you say in that proffer won't be used against you to enhance your sentence or charge
you. Anything that you say to the government.
To the government, the prosecutor.
And, okay, so my letter.
There's no deal in that letter saying anything you say directly to the judge has to ignore.
All right, let me.
Suppose your client had stood up during his allocution and said, I'm actually not sorry for this at all. I just wish I'd distributed this more widely.
Right.
Would you be standing here saying the judge had to ignore that because it's all part of one big process?
Of course not. But that's inconsistent with acceptance of responsibility, isn't it? Of course not. But that's not what we're talking about here. Everything has to be truthful. And you want to separate it out when my guy gets up there.
What I gave you was truthful.
Okay, well, let's back up for a second. You just said something about me giving a statement to the government.
I've been crying crocodile tears until now, but here's the real truth. I'm sorry I was such a piker.
Well, here's how I see this. Let's assume for a minute that you just said something I say to the government can't be used against him. Isn't that what my letter of August 8th says? And why do I do that? Because I want to correct the factual inaccuracy that he testified about. I could have let it go, but I didn't think that was right. Number one, because it's inconsistent with acceptance. It's inconsistent with being 100% truthful in your proffer. You can't do that. And I don't want to pull the wool over his eye. So what happens is I send a letter.
As I said, that was very forthright of you, but your client did make a statement to the court that was untruthful, and you had not yet had the protection of the proffer letter signed by the government.
But see, that's where I disagree with you, because it had been talked about. It had been negotiated. It was coming. He just didn't get around to it. So the lesson that you're telling me is don't ever plead again to something like this until you get the proffer letter signed before the plea.
No, the lesson I'm telling you is don't rely on proffer protection until you've got the proffer in writing.
Well, and I think that's being sandbagged, to be honest with you. Because to me, a negotiation with Mr. O'Shea that I've known for a long time, to me, that's being sandbagged. Because we knew this was all coming. We knew that there was going to be a proffer. And there was no reason not to take him at his word and me having the understanding that that's what was going to happen. You know, the Richardson case talks about that, and so does Farmer. And Farmer says a proffer is a binding contract. And again, this court is trying to separate the proffer from the whole plea process. And I don't think you can do that. I think it's all part of one. Think about this. If what you're saying is true, I should have shut my mouth at the plea. I should have told the judge, hey, Judge, he's not going to answer that. I'm telling him not to. It's not an element of the crime. And proffer and plea negotiations, I'm given something, they're given something. I'm given the 100% honesty, they're supposed to give me something back. What are they giving me back? A stab in the back, because I'm not my client's honest with them. The only way that he loses acceptance or that proffer is if he testified differently or if he introduced evidence to a contrary position. He never did that. He always accepted responsibility for what he said. And I think your position that we break this down separately completely contradicts the whole purpose of this negotiation process. You be honest with me, we'll give you something back. I want to talk a little bit briefly, just real briefly, about that picture. And I think this should be a de novo review. You three can make the same decision by looking at that picture that a judge could have made. You can look at it, you can analyze it, you can make that
Anderson
determination.
Against Bessemer City calls that a heresy.
Well,
right, it used to be that appellate courts would say the clearly erroneous standard doesn't apply to documentary evidence because the Court of Appeals can look at the documents just as much as the district judge could.
Right.
And the Supreme Court, by a vote of 9-0, said that's wrong. Even with respect to documents, the conclusions and inferences of the district judge stand unless clearly erroneous. Well, here you're making the same point the Supreme Court called heretical.
I think you and I went round and round on this one other time on state versus or government versus U.S. versus Villopando. Mm-hmm. It was a transcript of
And the decision of the Supreme Court is still now what it was then.
All right. Well, and again, just because one person says this is what I see doesn't necessarily make it so. And I do think it's a de novo review because, like I said, you can look at it. But, again, I understand what you're saying about the Supreme Court decision. I'll just move on. So we're back to, is the sentence unreasonable? The government says, well, you know, he got 98 months below the maximum. Okay. My response is he got 82 months above the minimum. Now, oh, boy, you could almost say, well, that's a split right in the middle. And I know these crimes are so despicable and so disgusting, it's hard to give any feeling or feel sorry for somebody than Mr. Schuster Shoes. He did it himself. There's no doubt about that. And it is a despicable and disgusting crime. But when you really think about it, who gets the maximum sentence? The worst offenders, the ones that have many victims, that traumatize the children, the child's awake during the assaults, the offender's not amenable to treatment. He shows no remorse. He blames it on others. He has a prior record. He has a poor work history. He's not a contributing member to society. That's who gets the maximum. Well, then on the other side, who gets the minimum? No priors. Amenable to treatment. Children aren't traumatized. He pleads out, as he did here. He agrees to cooperate. He's a productive member of society. And, you know, the sentencing is supposed to be sufficient, but not more than greater than necessary to support the factors under 18 U.S. Code 3553A. And I think this went way beyond this. You know, we're talking a 15-year minimum mandatory that sure isn't a slap on the wrist. It's a significant sentence for a 45-year-old man that has never committed another crime before this. And I realize, you know, it's presumptively reasonable that when the sentence is in the guideline range, I think she miscalculated the guideline range because I think she gave that two-level enhancer for what he said to her and what I said to her. And I think that is unreasonable per se, I think the sentence is, and I think it should be remanded for a new sentence if you agree with me. Obviously, I'm having a hard time convincing you of this, but again, you can't look at it in each particular thing. You have to look at it in the big picture. It's a plea process. It's a plea negotiation. There's give and take on both sides. And the point my client had to do was be 100% truthful, and he was at all times. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tim O'Shea for the United States. Even under kind of the holistic view that defense counsel takes here, there's no concern about sandbagging here. The defendant pled guilty on August 5th to the most readily provable, most serious readily provable crime. What did he get back? What he got back was the fact that his relatives and friends didn't have to testify to identify these children that he'd taken pictures of. When the defense attorney wrote that letter, when Mr. Eisenberg wrote the letter, he said why he wrote the letter. He didn't want the defendant to get in trouble with obstruction. Why obstruction? Defense counsel knew that there was an ongoing forensic examination of the computers, and if the government had found evidence of distribution, then Mr. Schuster's situation would have been more complicated in connection with sentencing. He would have lost acceptance. He would have gained obstruction. Mr. Eisenberg did the appropriate professional thing to mitigate the damage. And then the proffer, again, Mr. Eisenberg did a good job. He knew that the Dutch authorities, because of the peculiarities from our perspective of the system in the Netherlands, were required to talk to Mr. Schuster, and Mr. Schuster cooperated. The Hello Alex series, according to Mr. Eisenberg in page 11 of his brief, Hello Alex issue never came up in connection with the proffer. It's wholly different from the proffer and whether that was distributed. Mr. Eisenberg did a great job. But, you know, there, even under the holistic view that he takes, there's no issue of sandbagging. And let's turn then. There are two reasons that the court knows that the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding that there was distribution. Well, one way to find distribution, right, is production with the intent to distribute, according to the commentary and the guidelines. And, you know, these are kind of unique pictures. There's a card addressed to a third party placed near the child's penis and scrotum. It says, "Hello, Alex," on one, and then the next one asks Alex what he thinks of the child's penis. Because of the very nature of these particular images, there's no real dispute that they were anything other than those images were produced with the intent to distribute to another person. And then we get the idea of the defendant's letter. And it was clearly a letter wholly apart from the proffer. It was a letter written to influence the court. He talks about what a hard worker he was, what a difficult child he had. He talks about how he tried to be a good father, his contributions to the community, his church, and so on. He asked for a low sentence, and he asked for a second chance. And within that, he admits to the distribution. It's clearly the court was not party to the proffer, and this letter is written to influence the court's sentencing determination. Even putting aside Mr. Eisenberg's August 8th letter, there's two compelling reasons to find that there was distribution, and it was completely different from the proffer. The second issue is relates to the little boy in the tub, and that's for the government. This was a harder thing, just in terms of sort of the logistics of how to get that image to the court, and quite frankly, we were perplexed on how to do so, I brought it, as I said I would, and I said in my brief that if the court directed me to do otherwise, I'd do otherwise. I've got it here for the court. There's a post-it note on it. I've never approached the appellate court. I've approached the district court plenty of times. Is it okay for me to approach and provide, you know, this image to the court? I don't know how else to do it, so I guess I'm asking the court's permission, or if the court has any better ideas, I'm all ears. Well, that's deafening silence by the end. Well, let me go on with my argument.
There's no legal obligation to go on.
What's that, Your Honor?
Says you have no constitutional requirement to keep talking. And you, too, have the right to remain silent.
Okay. And the more silent is better, the closer we get to lunch. Well, in light of the privacy interests of the child, we talked about trying to have a written description of the images. We didn't. I respectfully submit the court's decision was not clearly erroneous. There was a lascivious exhibition. The focal point of the image is the little boy's genitals. That's a factual conclusion that the district court made. Is possessed by a person who had touched the boy's penis without permission and who clearly had a strong interest in creating, storing, and sharing child pornography. And then, you know, in terms of the reasonability of the sentence, the district court did thoughtfully analyze it under 3553A. There were positive things about Mr. Schuster. He's a complex person. But the other reality of Mr. Schuster is that he had exchanged child pornography with this man over in the Netherlands. He had asked that man to engage into videotaped specific sexual acts with children. He had taken and created child pornography with children who were close to him, and who he had also, his emails indicated that there were other kids out there who were as yet unidentified. In light of all that, the district court was you know, was perfectly appropriate and did not abuse her discretion in imposing the 262-month sentence. So, with that, unless there are any other questions of the court, I will invoke my right to silence and sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Eisenberg?
The government asked, well, what did he get back? Well, sure, he got the 5K1 six-level departure, and he got the acceptance of responsibility, but he also got two levels up for being honest. The government says, well, there was proof of production with intent. How does the government know that Alex was a real person? How does the government know that this wasn't some fantasy of Mr. Schuster? It doesn't, unless he says that to him. And while Mr. O'Shea wasn't there for the 15 hours that the Dutch agents were interviewing my client, I was. Unfortunately, Mr. O'Shea didn't get a report, and I didn't get a report because there was some international problem with giving us a copy of the report from the Dutch agents. But I will tell you that Alex person was discussed, and the Alex person was a real person, and he was in Germany or something. You know, if Mr. O'Shea's arguments are right about production, intent to production is enough, then how come we didn't get the production on the bathtub series? How come we didn't get the production on enhancement on the other child series? Because we didn't. Because that wasn't it. You had to actually have proof of it. Finally, I wanted to end with the Farmer case. A proffer agreement is a binding contract enforced according to its terms. However, proffer agreements that are part of ongoing criminal proceedings are unique contracts, and the ordinary contract principles are supplemented with a concern that the bargaining process not violate the defendant's rights to fundamental fairness under due process. That's what this case is all about, and that's what I'm saying he didn't get, and that's why I think you should reverse it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Eisenberg, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.